Hi, welcome to the New Books Network, New Books in Native American Studies. My name's James Mackay, and I'm here with Professor David J. Carlson. Professor Carlson is a full professor of English and currently the chair of the English department at California State University, San Bernardino. He has a background and research interests in American Indian literatures, colonial and early national American literature, science fiction, and critical theory. And the book that we're here to talk about today is called Imagining Sovereignty, Self-Determination in American Indian Law and Literature. So, David, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, James. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And I should mention for complete transparency that David and I also co-edit a journal together, but that's not what we're talking about today. Right, so could you just give our listeners a general idea of who you are and how you first came to work in Native American studies? I understand that you yourself are not Native.
Correct. Well, let's see. I have a PhD in American literature from Indiana University. Which I got finished about 17, 18 years ago. In terms of how I came to work in Native studies, I think there are two or three different inspirational sources that fed into that. I guess one would be a course that I took as an undergraduate student. Actually, I minored in religion as an undergraduate, and I took a wonderful class on American Indian religions and religious traditions from Chris Vesey at Colgate University. And Chris has done a lot of interesting work on Anishinaabe, Ojibwe religious practices, on sort of both traditional and syncretic, kind of connecting Catholicism with traditional practices. And it was just an eye-opening course for me to see radically different, complex ways of comprehending the world, our place in it, human ethics, the sort of threads that tie communities together, both, and I think for indigenous people, those communities are both, I suppose, what Westerners would call human and animal and natural and environmental. So that was an inspirational course for me. Then I came back to Native studies as a graduate student, sort of through the other side, in studying American literature, particularly colonial and early American literature. I was continually struck by the ways in which indigenous peoples were represented in those literatures, and I didn't have a language for it at that time. But you know what I see now is what I was seeing was the literary side of what we now call settler colonialism. The ways in which indigenous people have been systematically and instrumentally displaced, oppressed, dominated by Western societies. And I knew those representations were fundamentally wrong, but I couldn't quite articulate how they were wrong. And that sort of led me into the traditions themselves, sort of starting to learn about Native literatures, learn about indigenous societies, indigenous communities. And then I think the third thread that then pulled me into the specific kind of work I do now is a theoretical lens. I was studying a lot of new historicism at that time period. This is thinkers like Michel Foucault, and thinking that comes out of people like Marx, and particularly interested in the ways in which we as individuals and societies are subjected to power structures that are often invisible to us. In a Marxist tradition, people would call that ideology. The new historicist would just simply tend to call it power or discourse. And I was reading Alexis de Tocqueville's classic Democracy in America, and reading some of his thoughts about law. And he has this wonderful quote about law that actually I think I would like to share briefly in Democracy in America. And he actually writes, he writes, while the language of the law has become in some measure a vulgar tongue, the spirit of the law, which is produced in the schools and the courts of justice, gradually penetrates beyond their walls into the bosom of society. And for me, that quote sort of opened up an intense interest of mine in thinking about law, the language of law, the institutions of law, and how those structures, ideas, ways of understanding who we are as people, how we interact, how that permeates into society in ways that are complicated. And tying that together with my interest in sort of colonialism and Native American studies, what I started looking at was essentially legal discourses, the legal discourse around indigenous people, U.S. Indian law, how that's been constructed, how that's been used over the past three centuries, and how indigenous people have responded to that. So is that a reasonable answer for you?
Yeah, absolutely. With law and literature, obviously, both have particular structures indigenous people's experiences. So would you talk a little more about that?
I lost a little bit of what you said. I think you said talk about how the law structures indigenous people and their experiences. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. There are a number of facets here, and I think it's dangerous to generalize globally. There are some, I suppose, broad patterns, and obviously most of my work focuses in a U.S. context. I look a little bit in a Canadian context now, but you know, broadly speaking, the legal apparatus around indigenous peoples in Western democracies largely derives from originally from the Middle Ages, frankly, from the Law of Crusades, legal structures that were designed to legitimize the conquest and dispossession of people deemed to be fundamentally different from Europeans, whether from a religious perspective, cultural perspective. And the sort of law, what comes to be known as the law of discovery, the kind of legal apparatus that underpins colonization in the New World, grows out of that medieval heritage. I mean, it's not a coincidence that that Spain was one of the leading frontline sort of powers in both in terms of the colonial occupation, so to speak, and manipulation, I suppose, of the New World, but also in the kind of legal structure. The Spanish had just finished expelling the Moors from the territory of Spain right when they turned their eyes to the New World, and they essentially translated some of that legal apparatus into a New World context. So I think one facet here is the law of discovery tends to, and I should say the law of discovery is still a part of the U.S. legal system. It still is embedded in our thinking, our understanding about indigenous peoples through some key Supreme Court decisions in the 19th century, the Cherokee cases decided by John Marshall's Supreme Court. But that law of discovery essentially makes it distinguish between civilized people and quote civilized people, quote savage people. It makes distinctions between the kind of possessory rights that you have over land. Broadly speaking, civilized people, quote unquote, have superior rights to take and hold land as property, as real estate. And it also limits in fundamental ways, consequently, the ability to determine your own political and social destiny on the part of Native peoples. And that's the dimension that we talk about in relation to the concept of sovereignty, right? Well, I think, sovereignty is a concept that has a long heritage and is used in multiple ways. It's really rooted in early modern legal traditions, I would say, and initially in sort of rebellions against the authority of the universal church. So it initially emerges as a way for, I think, nation states as they're developing to define themselves as discrete political entities that have their own authority, their own control over territory and people. So I think it's fundamentally tied to the emergence of modern nation states in that respect. But it gets inflected in different ways. I mean, I think in some contexts it's really inflected as an idea that talking about essentially power over people, so to speak. Who has authority? Who has legal authority? What entities have legal authority to impose rules or order or punishments on others? where does that power reside, so to speak, is what we're talking about when we're talking about sovereignty. And, you know, so in an indigenous context, in the United States in particular, I think the key precedent here is the Marshall case, one of the Marshall Cherokee cases that designates Native peoples in the United States as what he calls domestic dependent nations. And essentially what he means by that is that these are autonomous groups that we recognize, autonomous communities, that are political entities, but are not nation states in an equivalent way to the United States. So what Marshall's decision sort of designates as a legal status for indigenous peoples is fundamentally they're a bit like wards of the state. They have authority over themselves, but that authority can be superseded by the United States government, essentially. And that pattern has played out historically in Congress has asserted, and this has been validated by the Supreme Court, something called plenary power, which essentially says that Congress can do anything it wants to fundamentally in relation to the tribal peoples that live within the borders of the United States in terms of limiting authority, shaping tribal governments. Now, that use of that power has ebbed and flowed historically, largely as a result of political pressures, activism, but as a strict matter of law, indigenous tribal communities in the United States right now could be abolished by legal fiat. Does that mean they would cease to exist as communities? No, but they would certainly cease to exist as recognized legal entities. And there is a history in the United States in the 1950s and 60s, a policy called termination that actually did, with some tribal communities, eliminate them as political entities. So I think I may have drifted a little bit off your question, but again, I think broadly speaking, I think sovereignty is from a Western perspective, it's the idea of where power resides within a political structure, power that can be used to organize society, regulate society or peoples. I think the way indigenous communities have reinterpreted sovereignty or adapted that concept, grasped onto it, is to try to turn that around and think about sovereignty in relation to the concept of self-determination, the idea that the legal and political idea of sovereignty should underpin the notion that we recognize the rights of communities to determine their own fate and their own destiny. So I think a lot of indigenous communities are using the word sovereignty, asserting their own sovereignty, not in the sense that they're trying to take power over others, but in the sense that they're trying to take power back in order to shape their own political destiny. So does that give you enough, James?
Indigenous peoples, you quote a couple of theorists, Russell, Lawrence, Walsh, and Teaki Alfred, who both say that sovereignty as a European concept is not useful for indigenous peoples' sort of self-understanding. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, I think this is part of, I think, a long-standing argument in Native studies. I think within the field, I think it's fair to say that most, if not everyone working in the field is broadly committed to the idea that decolonization is sort of the fundamental goal of Native studies, right? Doing work that supports the ability of indigenous communities to sustain themselves, to resist ongoing pressures, ongoing colonial pressures. What the arguments have tended to be about is about tactics, so to speak, and sort of what strategies are the most effective to use along those lines. And there's one school of thought, and Alfred is a key voice in that. There are many others, people like Glenn Coulthard, people like Audra Simpson, I suppose people like Mark Rifkin. There are a lot of others who sort of think this way. And I think for legitimate reasons, what they worry about is that is essentially I'll paraphrase from another literary tradition, you can't use the master's tools to deconstruct the master's house, right? I think if the argument is that, let me put it this way, I think if my argument were that indigenous people should adopt Western legal structures as their own, and simply adapt to those structures in a very uncreative way, then I think Afford would be right. You know, that if that essentially is colonization, that's simply accepting these structures that have been imposed on you, structures that are going to potentially fundamentally change the way you think about yourself and your communities. I don't think that's the way most tribal communities or many tribal communities sort of use the idea of sovereignty. I think there's actually a lot of creativity out in Indian country in terms of thinking about how this concept that has a Western origin for sure can be reinterpreted, re-understood through an indigenous lens, through the lens of indigenous worldviews or indigenous political practices. So I think people like Alfred sometimes underestimate or underplay the ways in which putatively alien concepts can be creatively reused sort of within indigenous communities. At the same time, I also think there's a kind of practical or pragmatic dimension here too, which is that the power of the U.S. state in relation to indigenous communities, the power disparity is enormous. And to some degree, I think most tribal communities are obliged to work with and within some of those structures, at least to some degree, right? As a tactic, maybe not as a sort of long-term goal, but a recognition that the legal structures, the political structures that you have to deal with right now are the ones in front of you. And so to opt out of those structures completely because they are not part of your historical traditions, I think is a risky political strategy to take. So I guess that would be my two responses, that as a tactic, if not a long-term goal, sovereignty has utility, but also that I think indigenous people make use of the concept in complicated ways. And let me maybe give you one quick example of that sort of creative reuse. And this is somebody I talk about in the book a little bit, Vine Deloria, really important writer, legal thinker, political leader, religious thinker. Started writing in the 1960s, hugely influential in Indian country and thought for 30 or 40 years and into today. And in his book, We Talk, You Listen, he's writing a lot about sort of the U.S. Constitution and constitutionalism. And he focuses particularly on the preamble, that famous language, we the people in order to form a more perfect union. And one of the things he does in his argument is sort of point out that for most Americans, I suppose people like myself growing up with the kind of civics education I had, when I hear we the people, I probably think we as a group of autonomous individuals who sort of come together in temporary ways and limited ways to do certain things politically, right? We think of the people as an amalgamation of the fundamental political unit, which is the autonomous individual, right? That's the core of American individualism. What Deloria points out is that for indigenous communities, the people themselves are the starting fundamental unit, so that an indigenous person can actually make use of that constitutional language. But in fact, when they use it, they're using it differently. And to a degree, that meeting point, that debate about what do we mean by people? How do we understand the relationship between the individual and the collective? That becomes a point of contact between indigenous political traditions and non-indigenous political traditions. And that's a place where maybe something can happen, something interesting can happen in terms of innovation, or at least space can be carved out for different modes of governance and political organization, at the local level. I'm not sure that some native tribal communities, I think, would love to be fully autonomous in every sense, the equivalent of, I guess you could say, nation states. Many would not. And I think many would actually say that kind of move would be antithetical to their understanding of their own political structures, and maybe also just impossible to achieve in terms of contemporary population levels and resource levels. So again, I think there's a lot of examples of ways in which creative people, political leaders, legal leaders, writers, individual citizens, individual tribal members within Indian country, I think are recognized that, again, these putatively alien traditions can be can be used and manipulated in ways, can be indigenized, would be a better way for you to put that, or at least have the potential to do that. And I think that's true. And again, I think that would probably be the fundamental difference between myself and somebody like Alfred, who's, I think very skeptical that that indigenization can happen in a significant way.
You talk about DeLorean sort of emerging from a vox populi tradition in American Indian thought. Could you talk a little bit about that as well, Nagel and Costa?
Oh yeah, I think part of DeLorean is sort of someone who is emerging at a moment. You know, that moment, the 1950s, 1960s is I think the beginning of the real emergence of the kind of contemporary, I guess what you could call indigenous public sphere, sort of at a broad level. You have, I talk a little bit about Rupert Costa, who was Kuwia, historian, researcher, publisher, published the first national Native American newspaper, essentially called Wasaja, which is named after an earlier Carlos Montezuma's earlier newsletter. And people like Costa and people like DeLorean, I think, were instrumental in creating some people would have called this pan-Indian, I guess. I'm not sure if I want to use that term, but a kind of broad community of political consciousness, political thought that cuts across and unites indigenous people across different tribal affiliations, so or tribal identities. So, you know, there have been moments, of course, where I think and these sort of start in response to colonialism, U.S. colonialism in the early 20th century. But these earlier moments, I think, really flourish in the 1960s, where suddenly an indigenous person who is Diné or Navajo, as perhaps more commonly known to non-indigenous people, or Anishinaabe, think of themselves not just as members of their own tribal community, tribal culture, but think of themselves as indigenous in a broader political sense. Recognize the kind of commonalities of the way that they have encountered and have to deal with the power of the settler state. So that emergence of this, I guess, national discourse, national print culture, national public sphere, coincides, probably not coincidentally, with the grabbing onto concepts like sovereignty and self-determination as ways in which indigenous peoples can organize themselves politically, and again, not just at the local level, but at the national level, and you know, by extension, over time, at the international level. This has moved. You know, the discourse of sovereignty and self-determination has extended into international law too, with the pressure to get the international community to recognize and acknowledge the rights of indigenous communities. And, you know, the current sort of culmination of that is the UN's Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is a kind of sovereignty text. It thinks about sovereignty in very particular ways, but the political activism that created UNDRIP, which is a terrible acronym, isn't it? The political pressure that created that derives from that construction of this broad public sphere that is now, it's an international public sphere, right? I mean, I think in indigenous studies today, we have writers and theorists in North America talking about significant parallels that they see between their political struggles and experiences and the experiences of Palestinians, for example. This has become a kind of globalized discourse, which this would take us down a long rabbit hole, which I think in the long run is going to complicate how effectively sovereignty itself is going to function as the sort of key term of innovation. I suspect we're going to move beyond sovereignty in the next few decades to something else, some other framing concept for thinking about decolonization.
Yeah, and you finished the first half of your book, which is a discussion of sovereignty, with the work of John Mohawk and the Iroquois idea of sort of an ethics of sovereignty. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that would be another example of, again, what I see as that sort of innovation that you see within indigenous, political and philosophical traditions. to take ideas that might be inflected in a particular way from a sort of Western political tradition, use those same terms, but fundamentally, redefine them. So I think a way that this plays out in interesting ways, I think, would be when you think about a discourse of rights, right, political rights, and in a kind of Western liberal political tradition, particularly as it's developed in the United States, rights are the concept of rights is tied to the notion of the autonomous individual. It's tied fundamentally to issues of property, private property. We think about even our intangible rights, things like privacy, right? We think of those as more analogous to property rights than to other kinds of qualities that inhere in us in people as people. And what Mohawk does in his own political theorization, and what I love about writers like Mohawk is that on the surface what his essays are deceptively simple, right? But when you actually dive into them, they're tremendously profound and tremendously complicated. What Mohawk sort of points out is that your identity as an individual who possesses what we might call sort of rights, so to speak, within the political tradition, political community that he comes from, is tied to the idea of being. He would call it to being a good person, which sounds facile in a way from a Western perspective. It sounds like a greeting card phrase, but in an Iroquoian tradition, that's a tremendously complicated concept. Your peoplehood, your personhood, how that relates to your place within community, your roles, your responsibilities, and so when you're thinking about something like rights within that. Political community, you're thinking about it in a very different way than you would be in a typical sort of liberal Western, I think, political sense. And I think what writers like Mohawk, who writes essays in English for people like us to read, I think one of the things that Mohawk is trying to do is to point out that within our own political tradition, within the political traditions of even settler colonial states, there are spaces in which we can rethink our own sense of ourselves and how we understand and define our own communities. That essentially the liberal political systems that underpin both U.S. democracy and U.S. settler colonialism can be rethought from within, and it can be rethought from within, frankly, through indigenous political concepts. And I think that's a powerful insight, And I don't mean to sort of suggest that writers like Mohawk, their primary project is to, save the United States from itself. But I think in some ways, I don't think that's an inaccurate statement. That a lot of the work that you see, the thinking that you see coming out of Indian country, recognizes that. We're all connected now, essentially, and that we're going to evolve together, or we're going to, or we're going to sink together.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the black protests and things like that, and indigenous peoples are sort of at the forefront of the debates in the States at the moment, aren't they?
Right. And I think, you see this, I think, all over the place in terms of the, current environmental debates about climate, a lot of thinking about the Anthropocene, sort of, where are the fundamentally creative ideas going to be coming from that are going to sort of help us collectively move forward? And I certainly have a bias towards the idea that it's time for the West to look more to indigenous communities and their traditions to sort of find some answers to these problems that we have created.
Okay, well, that takes us to the second half, which in many ways is the focus of the study, isn't it? The idea of imagining sovereignty, and in particular, take on three writers who straddle a sort of divide between theorist and novelist or poet in some cases as well. Craig Womack, Elizabeth Cooklin, and Gerald Visner as your sort of principal focuses for all those three chapters. Why of all the major thinkers in Native American studies did you pick these three? What appealed to you about that?
Well, I picked these three in large part because I think they've been conventionally understood as people who are completely opposed to one another. And I wanted to try to highlight commonalities or ways, at least, in which that the differences between the way these three writers and thinkers reflect on colonialism, decolonization, concepts like sovereignty and self-determination, that we would be well served to look at to see them as sort of different approaches to the same problem that can be potentially complementary than seeing them as diametrically opposed thinkers who have to be chosen between. And I think there've been two real central critical debates in Native American literature in particular since the 1980s or so. And in a way that the second debate is a kind of reformulation of the first one. But the first debate was largely an identity-centered debate, right? What does it mean to be American Indian? What is authentic American Indian identity? Is it a hybrid identity that involves kind of the combination of, for lack of a better term, traditional elements and sort of new elements that come in the wake of colonial contact? Or is it a sort of adherence to something more separate, so to speak, at the level of personal identity? And that debate, I think, then translated into a more kind of political context in the wake of the work of people like Craig Womack, people who I think style themselves as, or used to style themselves as, literary nationalists. And the contrasting terms then became nationalists versus cosmopolitans, sort of people whose work seems to be rooted in very specific tribal traditions and reinterpreting those, but focused at that level of tribal tradition, and writers who seem to draw more on an eclectic kind of palette of influences that include Western or European influences. And these debates got pretty sort of heated, and it really did turn into this kind of Manichaean, for a lot of people, this Manichaean binary, right? That, like, you know, you're either a traditionalist or you're a cosmopolitan. You've got to pick a side. And I think Cooklin is someone who Womack is one of the fundamental theorists and writers in that nationalist tradition. Cooklin is a sort of strident nationalist who herself has tended in her own writing to be very polemical in attacking other writers who she feels like are taking a political approach that she doesn't think is effective. And Visner would be one of the classic cosmopolitans, so to speak. So I wanted to look at all three of them, again, to highlight how, if you understand what each is doing as a broad project, if you understand that each is grappling with the settler colonial political system, each is trying to create and innovate in dialogue with that system, and each is focusing on different legal structures or different tools to do that, that's, I think, a more interesting way of explaining their differences. And also, I think, seeing them as different fingers on the same hand instead of two fists pointing at one another, if I can use that metaphor. Womack and Cooklin, Womack, I think, to the extent that I have a kind of critique of him in my book, I think what Womack has bumped up against is he hasn't sort of settled, I think, in his own mind about what specific tactics he would want to use to challenge the settler state. He's kind of moved from different tactic to tactic, and he has very interesting insights in all those areas. But he's, I think, wrestling with what the political program is going to be. So, and that's fine. You know, I think that's I don't think there's any reason to sort of castigate the person for that. So what I think I start with him as someone who kind of is laying this foundation. Cooklin is heavily committed to treaties and to a sort of very aggressive, uncompromising vision of nationalism as sort of separatism. Cooklin wants a Dakota nation to be its autonomous. I don't know if she would want it to be a state in a Western sense, but she wants an autonomous, completely autonomous political community. And she roots that in her reinterpretation of treaty law. Visner is a complicated case. Visner is someone who's been deeply invested in constitutional reform at the White Earth Reservation, which is where he's at the White Earth Nation, which is where he's from, where's his roots. But I think in that sense, what Visner is highlighting with constitutional reform is a way of, I think, working a little more within and within U.S. political structures than somebody like Cook Lynn would be. But again, what I tried...
Could you give a bit of background on Visner? Because I'm not sure everyone would be aware of his constitutional work.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I think there are a number of tribal nations within the United States that govern themselves to some degree autonomously under tribal constitutions, right? And these constitutions were generally written in the 1930s and 1940s in the wake of a law called the Indian Reorganization Act. It's passed in 1934, part of a policy that was called the Indian New Deal at that time. The constitutions that were written in the 30s and 40s, while they represent, I guess you could say, progress from the real low point that indigenous communities were at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, they're very much documents that were kind of written under the supervision of the Department of the Interior. They often very much kind of mirror U.S. political structures. And in the case of the Anishinaabe, they're constitution, the constitution for the what was called the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, which is it's a collective, I guess, of five different tribal nations, reservations at this point in Minnesota. That constitution really, I mean, to my eye, reads more like a Chamber of Commerce business plan than a political governance a real kind of political governance document. There's no tribal judiciary established there. Essentially, it's more or less a committee that sort of runs the political operations. And, you know, starting in the 1960s, 70s, and certainly into the present, a number of tribal communities have engaged in processes of constitutional reform. And in White Earth, there was a move to do this. Visner was centrally involved in a committee that was tasked with drafting a new constitution. That constitution was completed. It was passed by the Constitutional Convention, so to speak, that got together to create it. Then it went out for a referendum. It was actually passed and approved by the White Earth Nation itself. But since then, it's been mired in legal and political controversy. It's been opposed by other members of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, some of the other nations in that, I guess you would say, confederation. Its current status is sort of, it's not in force at this point, and its current status is uncertain. But what the committee that Visner was on, and Visner had a significant hand in this. He'll downplay it, but you know, he played a major role in drafting this document. That constitution is really interesting and profoundly innovative. It integrates Anishinaabe political concepts. I'm not going to try to say the Anishinaabe words because I'll butcher them, but concepts that translate into English as something like the good life. It integrates those fundamentally into the political structure of the community. It enshrines a kind of complicated system justice system, which would draw on sort of indigenous models of sort of jurisprudence. I think in the long run, models of restorative justice, I think would become more significant. There's a lot of things in it that are innovative in that respect, but it also looks in certain ways like the U.S. Constitution. It's this interesting, for lack of a better term, hybrid document. And then Visner has been sort of incorporating in various ways references and kind of the spirit of that constitution in his fiction in recent years. And so when I write about Visner, that's largely what I'm talking about is the ways in which the constitutional work that he did is part of his the literary work that he's doing. And all of that work together is an attempt to, I think, change change the political dynamic for his community, and so to create new spaces for self-determination. And Cook, and for Cook Lynn, Cook Lynn is doing something similar in her own fiction. She writes fiction that is deeply rooted in her own investments in historic treaties between the so-called Great Sioux Nation and the United States government. Treaties going back to the Treaty of Fort Laramie in 1850. And Cook Lynn is I think what she tries to do is to use fiction to get readers to see the land, see our relationship to the land, both on a kind of human level, spiritual level, personal level, and political level, in a way that is much more in line with the world that is imagined in those historic treaties.
Okay. Yeah, I was struck with when you were talking about the way that she forces readers to adopt particular strategies in reading her fictional works.
Right, right. Well, I think part of what this is, and I can't claim any sort of brilliant insight here. I think what I'm doing in a way is drawing from some very fundamental insights from formal literary criticism and reader response theory, but that any piece of writing, we'll focus on fiction, elicits our critical response in part from because of what it says, but in large measure because of what it leaves out. Right, what we read, what we see, causes us to ask certain kinds of questions, and to recognize certain gaps in our knowledge and seek to sort of fill in those gaps in particular ways. And all writers, I think, work this way, right? No writer is going to tell you everything about a room, right? When they're describing that room, no fiction writer is going to do that. maybe Henry James will come closest to it. But what they'll do is they will focus your attention on certain things. And I think a thoughtful reader, a well-trained reader, so to speak, or an attentive reader will start asking questions. Why am I looking at this? Why am I being asked to pay attention to that object? Why that conversation, right? This is what we do as critical readers. This is, I think, what we teach people as literature professors. And what Cook Lynn does is Cook Lynn, I think, often she expands those gaps, right? She leaves those silences more glaring and more open than many other writers do. She sort of challenges you as a reader. She confronts you with a clear recognition that there's something fundamental about this community that you're looking at, or this space that you're looking at, this landscape, that you don't understand sufficiently just by what's on the page in front of you. You have to go further to sort of make sense of that. So I think in her, I start off my section on her by talking about the poem that she uses as an epigraph in her short story collection, The Power of Stories. And the poem is on the surface, it's a very simple portrait of a landscape, right? And you're looking at a landscape along a river. You're looking at high tension wires, and you're thinking about that place, but the poem really, I think, leaves you as a reader with all sorts of questions about sort of where are we in place? Where are we on this river? What river is it? Why are these tension wires here? What's going on? And what you do when you sort of dive more deeply is you realize that what Cook Lynn is writing about is she's writing about the stringing of the national electric grid. She's writing at the development of hydroelectric power along the Missouri River. And those projects displaced her own home community, the community where her ancestors grew up or had lived was flooded essentially by dam building to create this hydroelectric power system. And Cook Lynn, I think, in her fiction and in her poetry, is always sort of pushing readers to dive more deeply into that history and to understand what an indigenous person sees when they look out at that sort of colonized landscape. And I think her hope is, on some level, that the more we can develop a shared understanding of place, the more we're going to be brought back to these sort of earlier moments where there was perhaps potential, right, to create a sort of shared understanding of, and I don't want to say possession of, but a shared ability to sort of live on the land. Does that answer your question, James? I think.
Yeah, that absolutely does. And there's so many other things I want to ask you about, and where the time is starting to press slightly. And I want to get particularly to the last chapter of the book, because you go into the situation in California, which in many ways really sort of tests the complexity of this idea of sovereignty that you've been talking about throughout the book. I was wondering if you could briefly sort of outline what's particularly unique about the Californian situation some of the things you talk about there about sovereignty in that chapter.
Right. Well, I mean, well, California is California. You've got a contemporary context that's complicated in the sense that you have many tribal communities. Some federally recognized, some still seeking federal recognition, some state recognized. But you have an enormous number of tribal communities of enormously varying size and land base. There are recognized, federally recognized tribes in California that have 5 people in them, and there are federally recognized tribes that own 15 acres of land. There are also tribal communities with larger land bases. We have some of the wealthiest tribal communities in the United States because of some of the casinos out here, but we also have some enormously poor communities. But so essentially what you have, though, is you have a context in which Cook Lynn's vision of a treaty-based nationalism just doesn't work, essentially. Very few tribes in or nations in California signed treaties with the U.S. government. There were actually a series of treaties signed right when California became a state in the 1850s. Those were taken back to Congress, never ratified, and only discovered, quote unquote, in the early 1900s. Interestingly enough, the California tribes that signed them thought that they were enforced and had actually relocated in many cases to live up to the provisions of the treaties. But essentially, those tribes ended up in a kind of claims process to get financial restitution for the violation of those treaties. But so essentially, treaty nationalism doesn't really work in California. At least it wouldn't work in the way it might potentially work for Cook Lynn and for the Dakota. Constitutionalism is complicated too, because many of the tribal nations in California don't have constitutions now. Some would want them and some might not want them. So what you need in a California context, I think, is even more of a spirit of innovation. You need to sort of think about any strategy that you can imagine that allows you to assert and extend your abilities, your capacity for self-determination. I think in a California context, a lot of the California tribes, I think, tend to be a little more litigious than nations in other parts of the country, in part because I think they recognize that working with the legal system sometimes is their best strategy. This isn't in the book, but the Agua Caliente, who I do talk about, I'm actually talking about that community and somebody writing out of that community. This is in Palm Springs. They are engaged in a lawsuit right now over control of water rights underneath the reservation. This is water that's used heavily by the city of Palm Springs. And at the moment, they're prevailing in that lawsuit, which is going to lead to a very interesting dynamic where if they continue to prevail here, there's going to be some kind of power sharing political arrangement between the water district that serves that incredibly wealthy community and the Agua Caliente nation. That's a different kind of sovereignty, right? It's going to, if that's not going to devolve into a destructive contest, what you're going to have is, I think, a redefinition of a sense of kind of collective peoplehood in terms of the connection that desert dwelling humans have to that land base and that water base. And that's going to be driven, I think, by litigation in the U.S. court system by a tribal nation. So again, that's a slight digression because that's not in the book. But what I do talk about in the book are again, I think, ways in which in California you have to have this sort of spirit of experimentation to try to find new ways to assert and reassert the ability to be a self-determined community. And the example I do focus on is an out of print work by a man named Francisco Potencio, who was the SIB would be the traditional term, the chief, so to speak, of the Agua Caliente Cuia, the Palm Springs band. And what he does in his book, the story is called Legends and Stories of the Palm Springs Indians. What he does in his book, in interesting ways, he tells a number of traditional stories. But if you look really deeply, what he actually is doing is remapping the landscape. A lot of what he's doing in his book is what the linguistic anthropologist Keith Basso would call place making. He's tying place names, physical geography, to narratives in a way that maps out a fundamentally different understanding of shared space. So you read his book and what you realize is there's a section that you're reading in, and all of a sudden you have this, I think, flash of recognition that what he's doing in a way is walking around the borders of traditional Cuia territory and putting down markers, sort of showing what those boundaries are. But then within the framework of that book, he is sharing that understanding with a broad readership. And he even has some pieces in that collection where he talks about integrating the Anglo pioneers who came into this territory into that landscape. So what he's doing, I think, is modeling a way of recognizing the presence and persistence of the Cuia people in this landscape and pointing towards ways that presence and I don't want to say ownership, but that place in the land is persistent, needs to be recognized, but also can be used then as a base for finding collaborative ways to exist together. And I think if I had known about, if the water lawsuit had been going on when I had published the book, I probably would have brought that in, I think, as an example of how that can start to play out in interesting ways that in a way seems very disconnected from this book from the 1940s, which is telling traditional stories. But I think in other ways, very much embodies that ethos that you see somebody like Potencio talking about. So how's that, James? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. On some final thoughts, and you do raise this in the last couple of pages, you made a very good case in this book for considering sovereignty as discrete, as driven by considerations of praxis, of being very sort of hyper-individualized to each tribe, the different circumstances shaping the meaning of sovereignty. So how can that then work in a pan-Indian context, do you think?
That's complicated. It's interesting because I was reading a review of the book a few weeks ago, and the person who reviewed it kind of at the end of the review made this comment that I wish Carlson would come out with a program. Like, what's the plan he advocates going forward? And I think on the one hand, I would be loath to do that for a variety of reasons. I think as an allied scholar, it's not my place to lay out the plan. B, I don't think there is a plan, and I think that's part of what I point out at the end of the book. I guess to speak to your broader question, I think there's always a balance, right, between the local political needs, right, the local imperatives, and sort of broader intersections, broader strategies, broader ways in which people can collaborate. I don't know that I know exactly where it's going to go, right? I think certainly self-determination as an umbrella concept, again, inflected in different ways, is at this point working to a degree in a U.S. context, right? That does become a kind of point of connection for a lot of tribal communities. It doesn't necessarily work in exactly the same way when you cross the border, however, into Canada, where you have a different history. The sort of treaty status of Canadian First Nations isn't the same. The Canadian Constitution sort of incorporates Indigenous communities in a different way than the U.S. Constitution does. So, while I think broadly speaking, a concept like self-determination has connections, provides the possibility for connections. Again, the way that gets inflected in local ways is going to be different. My guess is, James, is that I think where we're probably headed in terms of a pan-Indigenous discourse is heading back into or heading in further into international law and sort of some of the directions that UNDRIP is taking us. I think that we're going to see a resurgence of creative thinking about intersections between Indigenous legal perspectives and going back to some of the early kind of pre-liberal property-centered roots of Western natural law as a tradition, and see if there are ways there in which you can find points of intersection. But I think what you're going to see is real wrangling over the next few decades about how you take the kind of legal framework that you find in something like UNDRIP and make it work in a way that doesn't undermine key Indigenous values. And I guess the specific area there that's complicated is that the UN Declaration is a human rights document, and it's attempting to kind of take Indigenous worldviews, values, and needs and blend them in some ways with a kind of human rights discourse that is a little more that is in its roots is more tied to individual rights. That said, within the same kind of language and sort of thought structure that UNDRIP comes out of, you have nations in Latin America declaring rivers to be people with rights. So I think you have innovation already happening sort of within that framework. But I think what needs to be worked out is how can that be made to work as a tool for pan-Indigenous activism and political collective action in a way that doesn't then undermine also, I think, some of the more discrete kind of local activity that's going to go on that might use other concepts. I mean, I think what you see this in the United States, U.S. context, you will have tribal nations that are willing to and have supported investments in that sort of international law discourse, that kind of UN-centered discourse, but are also at the same time, filing suit against developers or power companies in federal court, and working on constitutional reform. So I think you're going to see a mix of those things over time.
Hey, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a wonderful talk. And the book, again, for everyone, is Imagining Sovereignty by David J. Carson. Thank you, David.
Thanks, James. This was wonderful. I had a great time.